We're very happy to welcome Professor Wayne Meeks from Yale University to speak to us this afternoon. He's been at Yale University for 22 years, and besides what you read on your program, I think it's interesting to note that he started out at the University of Alabama earning a Bachelor of Science degree in physics, after which he must have been seduced by religion because he went on to a Presbyterian seminary in Austin, earning there a Bachelor of Divinity. Then he studied in Tübingen, Germany, in a theological school. And at that point, he became a university pastor for the Presbyterian Church in Memphis. And then went on to earning a PhD from Yale University in religious studies with an emphasis in the New Testament. Professor Meeks has recently, within the last 10 years, written a couple of books that you may find out on the table. I think Benchmark Books has them. One is called the one that was published in 1983 is called The First Urban Christians. It was published by Yale University Press. That book was a co-winner of the Biblical Archaeology Review, which is a publication award for the best book on the New Testament in that year. And he has a book that was published in 1986 called The Moral World of the First Christians. And that was a co-winner of a prize given by the American Academy of Religion. It was an award for excellence in book publication in the historical category. And so we'll turn the time over to Dr. Meeks. If you would like to continue your discussion with him, or if there's no time for you to address your question to him, your program says that you could meet with him in room 740 after the presentation. That has been changed. Dr. Meeks will meet with anyone who's interested in room 306. And so we'll now turn the time over to him.
Thank you. I call this paper The Puzzle of Christian Beginnings, and that title may be a puzzle, for you would not think, after nearly 2,000 years of diligent inquiry into the subject, that the beginnings of Christianity would still be a puzzle. Or even if it is a puzzle, once we acknowledge that hard facts about the early years are very hard to find, at least you might think that there is nothing new that could be said on the question. In fact, however, the picture that historical scholarship has formed of early Christianity has changed significantly in recent years. Why has this happened? Doubtless one of the reasons is that there are a great many scholars like me who get tenure and earn their livings by trying to say something new. Still, granting some truth to this somewhat cynical observation, there are some more substantial reasons why we have had to revise our understanding of how early Christianity began. For one thing, some new evidence has turned up. The most dramatic discoveries have been widely publicized. A cache of 4th century manuscripts in Egypt, which shed extraordinary new light on one deviant movement in the early church, which we generally call Gnosticism. And the now famous Dead Sea Scrolls, which have shown us with some clarity the inner life of a sect of Judaism that was active for a century and a half before Christianity began, and which had many traits in common with it. As important as these discoveries and dozens of other smaller ones are, there's another factor that has worked even more strongly to shift our perspective on Christianity and its origins. That factor is our increased knowledge about the environment within which Christianity began and developed. Most of our new insight into that environment we owe to advances that have been made by scholars in other fields, particularly in the social and intellectual history of the Roman Empire and in the history of the Jews under Roman rule. Moreover, for a variety of reasons too complicated to go into this afternoon, scholars of early Christianity have learned to pay more resolute attention to the movement's larger environment than had often been the case in the past. What I hope to do in this paper is to provide you with just an introductory sketch of the way the puzzle of Christian origins met me as a result of the changed perspectives that I have just mentioned. I will begin by describing Christianity as one among several innovative movements and sects of Judaism that flourished in the first century of our era. To see the followers of Jesus as a sect of Judaism is the fundamental starting point for any historical account. However, for lack of time, I will pass quickly over that stage of the new movement's development. I will concentrate, for reasons that will become apparent as I go along, on what became of the Jesus movement when it moved from the land of Israel into the cities around the eastern Mediterranean basin. My primary aim will be to try to help you to imagine how this new movement would have been seen by ordinary people in those Greek-speaking cities. As a sect of Judaism, Christianity was not a success. That is not so surprising. It shared the fate of almost all the Jewish sects about which we know. It lasted about as long as any of them. The one exception, the one successful Jewish sect, was the Pharisees, if we can believe the conventional view that it gave birth to the rabbinic movement. I mean by this that the avowed or tacit reason for any sect's existence is either to convert or to replace the main religious tradition and organization over against which it has defined itself. It required several centuries and a great deal of luck for the rabbis to accomplish that, so that today when we think about ancient Judaism, we and most Jews think of rabbinic Judaism, even though that was a very small and struggling sect of Judaism in the third century. The earliest Christians tried to do the same thing, that is, either to reform or to replace the main structures of Judaism, but they failed. In that respect, they were like the Essenes and the other less well-known sects. So if they had remained a Palestinian Jewish sect, we would know as little about them as we knew about the Essenes before the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. For all of the literature of early Christianity that we have in our possession is written in Greek and outside Palestine. The Jewish sects in general, as far as our sources inform us, had little impact outside the land of Israel. The therapeutai, celebrated by the Alexandrian Jewish author Philo, were one diaspora group, but they appear to have been a very small and isolated phenomenon in a single location in Egypt. A sect, by definition, takes its shape in vocal or tacit opposition to the central institutions of its larger society. In Second Temple Judea, those central organizations were the temple and the priesthood. When the temple was destroyed in the year 70 of our era, the sects, accordingly, ceased to exist. They didn't have anything to fight anymore. We hear no more of Essenes. The Pharisees were apparently absorbed into the emerging proto-rabbinic movement. Sadducees are no more. For a time, some parts of the Christian sect defined themselves over against that emerging set of authorities, the rabbis, but its future lay elsewhere. The Christian sect moved to the diaspora, and that right early, long before the revolt of 68 to 73 CE. The second century Roman historian Suetonius reports that the emperor Claudius expelled Jews from Rome because of disturbances in their community caused by a certain Christus. The usual and probably correct interpretation of that report is that Christian missionaries had arrived in Roman synagogues by that time. Opinions about the date differ, but it was no later than 49, and possibly as early as 41. The followers of Jesus had found adherents in the Jewish communities of Syria much earlier even than that. First in Damascus, and then in the great metropolis of Antioch. It was at Antioch that the crucial step was taken, as we are told in the book of Acts, that some of the Greek-speaking Jesus sectaries who had been chased out of Jerusalem began to proselytize non-Jews. There, too, that outsiders first used for this sect the distinctive nickname Christus followers, Christianoi. The name stuck, and it marked a step on the way to having an identity distinct from the Jewish community. It was at Antioch, too, that Paul served his apprenticeship as a Christian missionary with Barnabas. After an earlier, apparently unsuccessful venture into the Arabian kingdom of the Nabataeans. The great controversy over circumcision that started at Antioch, though Paul thought or argued that he had won a moral victory in that controversy, nevertheless led, in fact, to his break with Barnabas and his, Paul's, departure and his organization of a quite new missionary enterprise in Asia Minor and in Greece. That controversy was still within the context of a Jewish sect, for the whole issue was whether male Gentile converts could be received into the community in any other way than that which had come to be prescribed in post-exilic times for proselytes to Judaism. The oddest thing of all, however, is this. As vehemently as Paul rejected that requirement of circumcision for male proselytes, nevertheless, his own understanding of Christianity, as most clearly laid out in the letter to Romans, remained that of a Jewish sectary. That is, he understood the new movement, including the Gentiles whom he thought it was his peculiar mission to incorporate, to be the fulfillment of the hopes precisely of Israel, its destiny consolid with Israel's, his proselytes merely wild branches grafted into the trunk of Israel. Paul does not, like the later author of Matthew's gospel, think of the kingdom as taken away from Israel and given to another people. He does not yet speak, as later Christians would, of the new Israel or of the true Israel. It is rather the conversion of Israel for which Paul, like every sectary, hoped. The irony, of course, is that the practical organization that Paul had created in his mission was, so far as we can discover from his letters, altogether independent of the Jewish communities that existed in the cities where he and his fellow workers founded their Christian cells. Thus, almost in spite of what Paul deeply believed, by the time he wrote his extant letters, these Christian groups were no longer effectively a Jewish sect at all, but were something quite new. What were they? The appearance of a new religious group in the cities of the Roman Empire was nothing unusual. Most of these imported cults, however, were the native religions of people who had immigrated. The Hellenistic and Roman periods of Mediterranean history were times of rapid growth of cities, of consequent movement of people from rural areas to cities, and also of a constant flux of people from one part of the Mediterranean to another. Every city of any size thus took on a mixed complexion as it acquired ethnic neighborhoods from the immigrants who settled near people who had come earlier from their homeland. A visitor today to those cities of Turkey and Greece whose Roman strata have been excavated can see the patterns of those immigrant associations laid out patently before the eyes. One of the most graphic instances is on the Aegean island of Delos, which, because it is now virtually uninhabited, has been almost entirely excavated. In the age of the Athenian-run Delian League, Delos had been sacred to Apollo and to his sister Artemis, who were supposed to have been born there. And in Roman times, a colossal statue of Apollo still towered over the central plain. As Delos had lost its political significance and become instead a major marketing center, waves of merchants from all over the world had come there, settled, and brought their own gods with them. There by the harbor, one sees a vast plaza dedicated by the Italian merchants to business and its patron, also patron of thieves, Mercury. Leading off from it is the avenue on whose verge still stand many of the row of monuments to the Greek Dionysus, those astonishing, giant, erect phalluses, which must have made Victorian visitors fairly giddy with what seems to modernize blatant pornography, but at which obviously ancient Greek eyes did not boggle at all. Off to the left are remains of a very grand community center of the immigrants from Beirut, dedicated to the god Poseidon, which was the Greek name they gave to their native god Baal Shamin. Ascending the hill above the theater, you come upon later arrivals, the several shrines built over succeeding generations to the Egyptian gods, Isis and Serapis. Over near the farther shore, in much plainer buildings, remodeled homes, were the community centers of the Jews and the Samaritans, better referring to themselves as Israelites of Delos who send their offerings to sacred Har Gerazim. At the time when Christianity was born, Delos would almost have made today's San Francisco seem parochial. Almost. And a similar confluence of peoples and their gods would have been evident in each of the cities where the Christian missionaries looked for converts, as one can readily see in the ruins of Corinth, of Philippi, or of Ephesus. In such cosmopolitan settings, it is not surprising that people would be curious about the rites of their neighbors, and some would sample them. Most of the rites were public and took forms which were fairly standard. Processions on festival days through the streets of the city, banquets in the anterooms of the temple, sacrifices on the altar of the god, salutations to the god's statue at set times. For some, there were special functions, like the popular healing gods, particularly Asclepius. And, of course, the rites of some gods seemed more exotic than others, exciting sometimes titillation and sometimes outrage by staid Romans of the older school, like the historian who was among the first to mention Christianity, Tacitus, and called it a wicked and novel superstition, which those three words are all synonymous in his vocabulary. Occasionally, too, a new cult would be organized, like the famous one satirized by Lucian of Samosata, the cult of Glycon, founded in the late 2nd century in the town of Abinotecus by a certain Alexander. Glycon, however, was only a new appearance and form of Apollo, and the things he was supposed to do, give oracles, provide miracles, were familiar enough. By and large, the cults that moved with their migrating supporters were variations on a few familiar themes, and they came to resemble one another still more as they assimilated to the styles and fashions of the modern Greek cities. Greek was everybody's language in the East, and the temples that every cult erected as soon as it could afford them were Greek too. The Jews and the Samaritans, to be sure, were a special case. They were different, and some people held that against them. However, the Jews of the Greco-Roman cities were not really so different as we have been led to believe, as we can see now from such discoveries as the magnificent synagogue that stood on the main street of the city of Sardis in Asia Minor, or the reserved section of the theater at Miletus, inscribed in stone on the backs of the seats, "This is the place of the Jews who are also pious." Or the list of the members and God-fearers with their trades and status designations of the synagogue at Aphrodisias. The really significant difference was their exclusivity. one could not fully participate in the worship of their god and also still casually share in other cults as well. That was thought odd in the Roman world, and in many eyes offensive, in a religious world characterized on the whole both by easy tolerance and frequent syncretism or mixing. Nevertheless, it was at least officially acknowledged that this exclusiveness itself was part of the ancient tradition of Israel, of Judean religion, and that therefore the Jews were at least behaving quite rightly in preserving their ancestral customs. One of the most problematical things about the Christians, you see, was that they also insisted on this same kind of intolerance toward other cults. Yet, once it was apparent that they were distinct from the Jewish communities and were not themselves of any particular ethnic origin, they had no ancient customs to excuse their intolerance. The Christians were not the first offshoot from an ethnic cult in the Greco-Roman world to take a form quite different from that of its native parent. I've already suggested that every native religion modified itself to some extent to fit into the world of Hellenistic society in the age of Roman imperialism. There were also a few instances of a radically new form of cult emerging from native roots in the new context. One of these was already widely established in the world in which Christianity began. That is the cult of the Egyptian gods Isis and Serapis. They were known as the Egyptian gods, but in fact Serapis was not part of the ancient Egyptian pantheon at all, but appears on the scene first in the 3rd century B.C. And the Isis, who became so popular all over the Mediterranean basin in the time of Rome's dominance, was very different from the ancient consort and sister of the underworld god Osiris. Indeed, many scholars think that the new cult was the deliberate and artificial creation of the Ptolemaic kings of Egypt in the Hellenistic age, made up in order to advance their imperial policy, which extended their interests far beyond the borders of Egypt. If so, they were extraordinarily successful, as you can easily see by reading Apuleius' famous novel, The Metamorphoses or the Golden Ass, or Plutarch's learned philosophical essay on Isis and Osiris, or the popular novel about the Ephesian couple saved by Isis's providential care, Xenophon's Ephesian Tales. There was another new cult with only tenuous native roots which sprang up just after Christianity, called Mithraism, the cult that became so popular with members of the Roman armed forces in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, so that there was a Mithraeum in just about every Roman camp town. Its chief deity, Mithras, M-I-T-H-R-A-S, had hardly anything to do with the very minor god of that name in the ancient Zoroastrian religion of Persia. So perhaps it's not so terribly ironic that the Roman garrison in the little town of Dura Europas, sent there to defend the borders of the empire against the Persians, should have been so enthusiastic about a nominally Persian god. They were enthusiastic. They built there a place. They remodeled a house. It went through successive remodelings until it was a grand home for the worship of Mithras in the 3rd century of our era. Archaeologists have traced the way the Mithraists of Dura progressed in that little border town from very modest beginnings in a private house through successive enlargements and remodelings until they had a thriving establishment. This was typical of the way other cults established themselves in a new place. Indeed, on the very same street where the Mithraeum of Dura was found, the Jews had gone through much the same progression to produce that wonderfully decorated synagogue whose painted walls so astonished scholars when it was unearthed in 1935. A few blocks down the same street, the Christian group had done exactly the same thing, though they were obviously still smaller and poorer than either the Mithraists or the Jews, and their house and its decoration were still fairly primitive by comparison. The adherence to a cult in a new place, whether the cult of their homeland or one of the new or modified cults that were attracting worshipers across ethnic lines, formed an association, a club. A club was one of the most characteristic phenomena of the Roman Empire. Clubs of all sorts were forming on every street corner. And having formed an immigrant club, they characteristically found a patron, a relatively wealthy person who would either pay for renting or building a suitable meeting place, or would permit them to meet in his or her own home. This patron might either be an adherent of the cult, or simply someone who wished to do a favor for some dependents in exchange for their support and honor for him. We have a number of inscriptions from antiquity which were put up to give proper recognition to such benefactors. When we read in the book of Acts about Paul moving in with fellow tent makers Prisca and Aquila, or accepting the hospitality of the Jewish adherent Lydia, a merchant of luxury fabrics, or staying in the house of Jason, who had the post bond for their good behavior, we are witnessing the use by the early Christians of this same familiar institution of patronage. The same is true when Paul sends greetings to the meeting at the house of Philemon, or of Prisca and Aquila, or Nympha, or when he reminds the Corinthian Christians of the special recognition they owe to householders like Stephanas. The pagan observer would have seen in these little household meetings a quite familiar phenomenon. Adherents to a newly imported cult were setting up as voluntary associations in private households. Although they showed few of the public trappings of a proper religion, they held no processions, they celebrated no visible festivals, they performed no sacrifices, they had no statue of their god, yet, like many of the new cults, they did practice an initiatory ritual, and they assembled at set times for a ritual meal. Still, there were important differences. Once it became apparent that Christianity was not, or not any longer, a sect of the Jewish community, then it seemed passing odd that it had no single ethnic root. The Christians did not come from anywhere. Tacitus, you will recall, still saw the superstition as Judean in origin, even at a time when in Rome it had become clear that they were not a part of the Jewish community proper. But even in Paul's lifetime, though he persisted in thinking of the Gentile Christians as somehow added to the stock of Israel, yet the communities he founded were overwhelmingly Gentile in composition. Their fundamental identity was not ethnic, in the sense of having a common immigrant heritage. In this way, the Christians resemble their somewhat younger rivals, the Mithraists, and in the strange exclusivity of their worship, they look like kind of pseudo-immigrants. Immigrants by conversion. The Christians were different from other Greco-Roman cults, further, as I've already said, in their sharing with Jews an extraordinary exclusiveness or intolerance of other cults. We cannot be sure, of course, that every convert to the new faith really separated himself or herself from participation in every one of the religious activities that permeated religious civic life in antiquity. In fact, in the Pauline groups in Corinth, an argument broke out whether a Christian was allowed to accept invitations to dinner with a pagan, or even to eat any meat from the local meat markets, since the principal source of publicly sold meat was the sacrifices that went on incessantly in the various temples. We must remember in antiquity that the chief pragmatic job of a priest was being a butcher, and all butchers were priests. The question remained controversial through the first century and was still being mentioned in Christian handbooks in the second. Most leaders were less liberal than Paul. Apparently, many individuals, on the other hand, were more. The principle that Paul insisted upon was the norm for the whole mainstream of the Christian movement. Even though, as he said, there are many so-called gods in heaven and on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, From whom is the universe, and for whom are we ourselves? And one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom is the universe, and through whom ourselves. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot share the table of the Lord and the table of demons. So a strong but wavering boundary is drawn between Christians and the other cults. A third and very significant difference between Christianity and most other cults is that they very early developed a translocal organization. The model for this development was clearly Jewish. For in Jewish scriptures and in Jewish consciousness, there was one people of God as there was one God. Yet the Christians developed a practical organization and maintained lines of communication among their scattered little groups more elaborately than even the Jews had done. The reason seems to have been simply the practical needs of the rapidly spreading mission in the latter decades of the first century. Anyone, for example, who has read Ramsay MacMullen's book on paganism in the Roman Empire and sees how loose and weak were any connections between the Isis cult in Ephesus, say, and that in Rome, in Alexandria, or in Memphis, how inappropriate it is to Dionysianism, must marvel at the complex network of connections, of visits, of letters, of mutual aid, of mutual meddling, of oversight, and complaint that connected those Christian groups to which and about which Paul and his disciples wrote their letters. No wonder that by the third century the emperors were beginning to regard Christianity not merely as a local secret society that might be politically or morally dangerous, but as a kind of international conspiracy whose structure in some ways rivaled the imperial bureaucracy itself. And when Constantine decided to join this cult that his predecessors and competitors had not been able to stamp out, he found that church bureaucracy and the bishop's schools that prepared for service in it were a useful source now for recruitment into the imperial civil service. The final external distinction that the astute observer of Christianity would have noticed, that in many ways this cult was more than or other than a cult. Not only did it lack many of the external features of a proper religion, it occupied itself with things that were not ordinarily the province of religion at all. For example, morals. When we read the letters of Paul, for example, or study the letters of the other leaders of the new movement, or the handbooks that it soon produced, it is really rather astonishing how small a place is given over to specifically religious in ancient understanding, that is, cultic matters. By far the dominant concern of all these documents is with the behavior of the members of the Christian groups. The preponderant form of the literature is exhortation or moral advice, with multiple ways of explaining and backing up the reasons for behaving in the ways advocated and holding the attitudes that are inculcated. The ancient reader would not have seen this as religious literature, but as examples of that set of genres so popular with literate pagans of the time, which the Greeks called psychagogia, the guidance of souls. The closest parallels were in the teachings of the leading philosophical schools, like the so-called diatribes of Epictetus, or the public speeches of such moralizing sophists as professional rhetoricians of philosophical bent as Dio Chrysostom of Prusa, or the rougher and more popular harangues of cynic preachers. No wonder that Christian apologists in the second century began to represent their community as not a religious club at all, for imperial agents had made that seem a rather dangerous designation, so they didn't like clubs of any kind, but a philosophical school. So that Justin Martyr, for example, describes how he went through all of the schools of ancient philosophy until at last he discovered the true philosophy, Christianity. It was not merely another cult. It made far more demands upon its initiates than any cult. Christianity was rather a comprehensive, intimate, and totalistic community which was at the same time an empire-wide organization with utopian claims. In this lecture, I have emphasized a few of the ways in which what we know about the beginnings of Christianity has been modified in recent decades. The changes have come principally in our knowledge about the cultural and social setting within which Christianity emerged. They have come about because of new discoveries, as well as through alteration of the ways in which historians interpret the evidence. The latter is part of the ongoing conversation that students of the past have with one another, and that conversation is an inextricable part of our own cultural experience, training, and conditioning. It is part of the way we see the world, simply because we belong here and now, and not in some other time and place. Neither side of this process of trying to understand the past will ever come to rest. We will never in this life come to the point at which we can say, "Ah, now I understand perfectly just who the first Christians were, and what they thought, and how they behaved, and why." We are always looking into badly polished mirrors we see in enigmas. We know then a great many things that our fathers and mothers did not know, but our knowledge is still in part, and our prophecy is not so great either. We know many things, but do we therefore better understand? A difficult question indeed. As we have seen, so many of our historical certainties undermined by additional evidence are replaced by different perspectives, many historians have become more humble, which is a desirable development. Some people, however, have gone beyond humility to counsels of despair. "History teaches us nothing certain," they say, "so let us abandon the search. The historical critical method of studying Scripture is bankrupt. Let us throw away those false canons of objectivity and suspicion, since they have not served to provide a firm grounding for belief." This reaction is altogether understandable, but I believe it is also quite wrong. The voices that call us to abandon the quest to understand Christianity's beginnings and its development within the best picture we can obtain of its historical context are voices of disillusion, indeed sometimes the voices of moral cowardice. In this lecture, I have stressed on the one hand those things which the movement that formed around the memories and beliefs about Jesus shared with other people in their time and place. On the other hand, I have also pointed to some of the unexpected combinations and transformations of those familiar things which show up in early Christianity when one looks at it within that historical context. Our attempts to understand the origin of this faith have always veered between these two poles. We are wont to claim that Christianity is explained either by what it has in common with other things or by its uniqueness. Surely either of those is an abstraction from the reality. Jesus was one among many prophets in Roman Galilee and Judea, about whom some people had notions he might be the restorer, the prophesied king, or the prophet, or the priest of the end of days. The cities of the eastern Roman provinces were teeming with religious associations, initiatory cults, and purveyors of moral reform. That was the world in which Christianity began, and no other. Its ways of belonging to that world, and the ways it was estranged from it, are equally parts of its character, and we must try to understand both if we are to understand how Christianity began.
Thank you very much, Dr. Meeks. We have time for some questions. Go ahead.
There was a certain time at which Christians became known for trashing other people's religions, knocking down idols and the like. Was that another evidence of something that was unique, that would have called itself to mind to the people of that day, or did that occur much later?
The question is when Christians began to physically try to destroy other cults, whether that represents yet another stage in this exclusivism that I pointed out earlier. Yes, it does. I regret to report that as soon as they had police power on their side, as once the emperor was a Christian, they began to do this, and to their credit, the emperors resisted this as much as they could. But yes, that certainly is an example of precisely the intolerance that the Romans, I must say, rightly feared about this new movement from the beginning. Yes?
In regard to your whole, the work of Gordon Smith, Jesus the Magician, in other words, in portraying Jesus himself, first century of Palestine, the early Christians?
The question is my opinion of the work of Morton Smith, the Columbia historian who unfortunately died 3 weeks ago. His most well-known book is probably Jesus the Magician, and he tries to depict the development of early Christianity within the context of popular religiosity and antiquity, especially as recognizable in the practice of magic in antiquity. And by calling attention to that, Morton Smith, who was one of the great experts in magic and antiquity, has performed a notable service in treating a whole area of experience which had largely been left out of account by most modern historians, with the exception of a few German scholars around the turn of the century and shortly thereafter. So he has performed a major service in calling our attention to, again, things which anyone in antiquity would have thought as they looked at the Christians. Morton Smith has done this in a very provocative and I must say extremely one-sided way, but in a way that provides lasting material. No one can ignore the magic papyri after that. Back here, yes.
To what extent is there documentary evidence outside of the New Testament concerning pre-Pauline Christianity, the Ebionites, and the Nazarenes?
The question is evidence outside the New Testament for pre-Pauline Christianity. There's no direct evidence. The primary evidence for pre-Pauline Christianity is the letters of Paul, because those are the earliest Christian documents we have. There's no extra Christian evidence at all for first century Christianity directly. The evidence from Roman authors first appears in the second century. And in every case, those authors are dependent upon informants who are Christians, so they have no direct evidence about it. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but our understanding of pre-Pauline Christianity comes by inference from primarily the Pauline text and more complicated inferences from other texts in the New Testament, which even though they are later than Paul, we may suppose, for various methodological reasons, reflect traditions that are older than Paul. Yes. The question is an assessment of Gibbons's famous work, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which he blames on Christianity, because he credits Christianity with having introduced a revolutionary idea of personal moral freedom. There's no easy answer to that question. One can easily say that's far oversimplified, but then almost anything that anybody says about antiquity is. It certainly points to something which I've been very much concerned about in recent years, and that is defining or answering the question whether there emerged in the first two centuries a distinctive Christian morality. I don't mean a Christian ethic. I don't mean intellectual reflections upon what is good, what is right, and so forth. I mean whether there emerged a sense of the moral life, which one could designate as distinctively Christian. And I'm finding that a devilishly hard question to answer for some of the reasons that I pointed to today, that any single question one asks, you know, what did the Christians do about this or believe about that, you can always find somebody else saying or doing the same thing. So there's nothing about Christianity that you can say, well, that's absolutely unique. And yet somehow, if you ask about the whole pattern, you say, well, no, there isn't anything else quite like that. But then you say, well, but what exactly is different about it? Then it becomes much more difficult to pin down. And I would disagree with Gibbon in terms of how you define that difference. But I do think that there is going on here a change of sensibilities. How much of that change Christianity instigated, and how much of that change was going on in the culture and in fact is simply represented by Christianity as the one surviving phenomenon out of many other, is probably impossible to tell. My friend and colleague Ramsey MacMullen and I argue about this a great deal. He says Christianity doesn't have any effect in antiquity. All these things are going to happen anyway, and Christianity is sort of one manifestation which happens to have lasted. I don't believe that, but it's awfully hard to refute him. Yes?
Well, then what was the negative?
Yes, a very good question. The question is, what about the Emperor Julian, who has a platform of reform? He wants to return the empire to what it was before Christianity corrupted it, to what we call paganism, what he calls Hellenism, notice. And it's clear that into this program of reform goes Julian's own childhood training in Christianity, so that he appoints a high priest who is to be a kind of bishop, a kind of overseer of a whole area, and he's to travel around and reform the cults in each local place. Unheard of in paganism before. And he writes to this high priest, you'd better establish some hospitals and arrange for food to be given to the poor and this sort of thing, because this is the way the Christians are beating us. So here is an instance where a Roman emperor who is in love with the old-fashioned Hellenism, the real Greek way of doing things, in order to restore it, he uses the institutions of Christianity so that really, in fact, he's creating a new thing. That's an excellent example of this interweaving of things. What you see by Julian's time, the Christians are all writing in Greek and they're thinking in Plato and trying to understand the relationships between God and Jesus in terms of Platonic forms. So the mixture is going on both sides. Yeah. Way back here. The question is, what were the specific accusations that outsiders made against Christianity? Oh, they accused them of doing things like eating babies and drinking blood and having great festivals in which they put the lights out. Some of them had the ingenious fantasy that Christians always had a dog present at every supper, and they would tie this dog to the candelabrum. And at a crucial moment in the festivities, they would throw a piece of meat so that the dog would run and turn out the lights. And then they said all kinds of lascivious couplings took place in which one did not know what relation one might have to the partner, so on. Well, after all, didn't Christians always talk about loving one's brothers and sisters? And didn't they have some kind of meal in which they talked about eating my flesh and drinking my blood? Why, obviously these people were a dangerous and malevolent superstition, as Tacitus said. Those are the principal kinds of things. What, in fact, were the problems? Because those are the kinds of things which some Christians said about others as well. Later on, after they got power, they said them about the Jews, or they said them about the Valentinians, and so forth and so on. It goes all the way down to the Middle Ages, as you know. So they don't mean very much. The question, what really offended the guardians of the Roman order about the Christians, is very hard to answer, very complicated, and I commend to you a series of articles that were published in the journal Past and Present about 20 years ago, I guess it must have been now. The most provocative and the most enduring of them is published by the is written by the Marxist Oxford historian Geoffrey de Saint Croix, and it's entitled "Why Were the Christians Persecuted?" And then there is a response by the historian Sherwin White, and then Saint Croix responds to Sherwin White, and Sherwin White responds again. All of those are collected and edited by Moses Finley, with some general term about ancient society, I don't remember. But that's a wonderful collection of essays which deal with the question, what really stuck in the craw of law-abiding, respectable Romans when they thought about Christians? Wow. How much time you got for dinner? The question is, how unique are some of the central Christian doctrines like incarnation and atonement and resurrection? This is a topic which has been at the heart of modern radical historical discussion since the turn of this century. It is the center of the German history of religion school, which try to find parallels everywhere and to explain everything on the basis of someone else having clear, which is a problem of infinite regress, you know. Somewhere back there, somebody had to have had an original idea. The responses to that question tend to depend a lot upon the perspective of the historian, with some people emphasizing the similarities and some people emphasizing the differences. And I think that that's something that's built into the whole process of historical understanding. You can't understand anything out of the past unless you have some kind of empathy with it, which means you compare it with something you know. And yet, on the other hand, unlike the natural scientist, knows that every historical event is unique, and so it's not ever really like another. Most of the parallels that were favorites of the history of religion school in the 20s and 30s of this century turn out not to be very persuasive. One of the favorites, just to name one example, was the notion that all of the Hellenistic mystery religions, as they were called, depend upon a myth of a dying and rising God, and that initiation into that God provides for the initiate a guarantee of immorality. Of immortality. The Christians responding to this usually said, "Guarantee of immorality." The trouble with that is, if you go back and actually read the texts, which are almost always texts written by Christian opponents of the mystery religions in the 3rd and 4th centuries, as we have no text from the mysteries. We do not know what happened in a mystery. We do not know to this day what the secret was that was shown by the Hierophant at the climax of the Eleusinian mystery or any of the others. They are wonderful guesses, which make for great reading. But there isn't any evidence. And from what evidence we have, there is, in fact, very little suggestion that at the center of the myth was a dying and rising God, in the sense that we understand the story of Jesus. And very little hint that it had anything whatsoever to do with any sort of notion of immortality or life after death. Indeed, Ramsay MacMullan, in the book I referred to, Paganism in the Roman Empire, dropped a bombshell by saying he can't find any evidence at all that most Roman religion had anything whatsoever to do with life after death, or that very many Romans either thought of that as a possibility or cared. So much for our popular understanding that everybody in the Roman Empire was living in this huge anxiety about death, and that the Christians finally came around and gave them the answer to it, so that they all immediately converted. The problem is, in fact, that we have very little evidence about those comparable religions. And what evidence we have makes some interesting parallels, usually not the ones that were made by the history of religion school in its heyday. Does that mean that these Christianity were unique. Yes and no. There wasn't anything else quite like them, I think. They emerge out of the peculiar experience of this particular movement, with its particular background in Judaism and its particular memory of a particular individual and some very peculiar things that happened to him. But at the same time, every single thing they said about him had parallels, belonged to the language, either religious or philosophical, of their time. And when you stop and think about it, it had to be that way, otherwise nobody would have understood what they were talking about, and indeed they wouldn't have understood what they were saying in the first place.
Thank you very much.